The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time now to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. And Jim, there's some activity on the Senate side already in the early part of 2023. What's this story?
And yes, we actually have had a state of Senate campaigning and Senate announcements. I mean, it started with last week in our last interview when we talked about Congresswoman Katie Porter down from Orange County, already announcing for the Senate, not even waiting for Dianne Feinstein to say she's retiring, which, yeah, I think this is even beyond politics here. You would think that, say what you will about Dianne Feinstein, and I don't think I certainly, and probably you, don't agree with her on much on the issues, but she is an icon of the Democratic Party nationally, and her long, long record of service should indicate a little bit more respect than what she's been shown by her fellow members of the party. But Porter's in the race. You have Adam Schiff, our friend Adam Schiff, as you remember, and Barbara Lee from Oakland. They're both in the House delegation. They want to run for the Senate too, but they're at least waiting until Feinstein makes her announcement. But already we see people hopping into Schiff's congressional seat. We had three announcements here this week of running for Schiff's U.S. House seat, and he hasn't even said he's running for the Senate yet. So it's, I haven't seen a cycle, frankly, start out like this ever, where we have this much activity in January of the off year. In Indiana, we have Congressman Jim Banks, a solid conservative four-term member. He's announcing for the Senate that the senator there, Mike Braun, already announced he's running for governor. And the former governor there, Mitch Daniels, who hasn't been on the ballot since 2008, he goes way back to the Reagan administration. He was George W. Bush's Office of Management and Budget Director before he became governor. He's 75 years old and is probably going to hop into the Senate race himself. So that May 2024 Indiana race will decide who the next senator is in the Republican primary. That's going to be hot. And then we've got in Ohio also a state senator who ran last time, Matt Dolan, came in third place but did pretty well and really had a strong surge at the end. He is a minority owner of the Cleveland Guardians baseball team. So he announced he's going to get into the race against Democrat Senator Sherrod Brown. And this is going to be one of the key races in the whole country to determine the next majority, because Brown's way left wing, but he's a real strong campaigner. And Ohio is moving decidedly Republican. So that's going to be one of the top races we see in 2024. And this Matt Dolan is, I think, proven himself to be a pretty good candidate. He's got a lot of personal money. He's not hard right, but, you know, he's certainly a pretty solid Republican vote, and he probably fits the state pretty well. So this could be an interesting development.
Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. What do you make of DocumentGate? First, you have the Justice Department and Dems going after Trump, and then, oops, we find out that Biden had some documents at three different locations so far. We don't know if there are more. And here's a clip from Secretary of State Antony Blinken addressing Biden's classified documents situation after learning that they were taken to Biden's former University of Pennsylvania office. Here's what he said.
I was surprised to learn that there were any government records taken to the Penn Biden Center. I had no knowledge of it at the time.
Ooh, that "I had no knowledge of it at the time" is one of those interesting lines, isn't it? On Tuesday, he says he'll cooperate fully if he's called for an interview by a special counsel investigating the matter. We had, of course, the attorney general kind of being forced into putting a special counsel for one because he had done the other. Talk about this story.
Well, and you notice, too, and here's another key indication that Adam Schiff is going to run for the Senate, because Adam Schiff said they ought to investigate this, too. So, like, I was amused at, you know, after all he's done to go after Trump and But I think the FBI is in a real bind here now, because this has gotten enough media that the double standard is so clear. And I think they have a much harder time going after Trump now on this very thing. But it may not stop them, but I think it makes it more difficult, because certainly they're not going to do anything to Biden.
Yeah.
And it just again shows the double standard. It's also interesting to see people like Blinken, people like Schiff, kind of not coming to his defense, which leads some to believe that this could be what they're going to use to try to get Biden out of the race. That a lot of the Democrats, I think, now are nervous that he does appear like he is going to run again. You know, they probably figure if they get Trump, then even Biden could beat Trump, but there's no guarantee of that right now. And I think they're getting nervous about DeSantis coming out and becoming the nominee, and then a DeSantis-Biden matchup probably doesn't look too good for the Democrats, and this could be part of what's behind some of them, even, like Schiff, saying, yeah, maybe we should take a look at this. This isn't right. So.
Yeah. Speaking of the potential Trump-DeSantis ticket, there were some rumblings about that as being a superpower ticket that would shore up the base and make things much easier for Republicans. What's your take?
I don't think you'll see that for a couple of reasons. One, they're starting to be a pretty good-sized rift now with Trump towards DeSantis. And secondly, they're from the same state now. And so you can't have members of the presidential ticket from the same state.
Well, isn't there a way where you, like, one time, I guess it was Cheney who kind of had to move to a different state, right? I mean, you could do
things.
He had
to go back to Wyoming. Yeah, he was living in Dallas at the time and would have made both he and George W. Bush from the state of Texas. So he had to reestablish residency back in Wyoming.
I mean, there's ways around this, but then you have an awkward situation where a governor would be living in a different state, which I don't know if he can do that. So, I mean, it gets confused.
Well, he can't do that under Florida law, and Trump's not going to reestablish residency in New York with the legal situation with them coming after him there. So I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay. Let's talk some of the other things to watch. What are you watching as this 2023 year develops?
I am surprised so far by the level of political activity we've already seen, and it just goes to show that, again, we are in a constant election cycle. There are no breaks anymore in terms of campaign politics, and I am surprised by the level of activity we've seen already, as we mentioned, in January of the off year, with now so many people coming up to say, I'm running for this, I'm running for that, and plotting for the next election, which is still almost 2 years away.
Mm. What about this New York Mayor Adams, who has gone down to the border and has been one of the lone Democrats to acknowledge that there's a border crisis and is very vocal about it, about how, look, the feds need to pay for this, that there's no more room in New York State. It's costing us, you know, like $1 billion. That's a little chip in the Democrats' armor, isn't it?
Well, yes, but it is typical of them, because now all of a sudden it affects him. So it's a different perspective, because now with people being sent into New York City that all of a sudden he has to take care of, oh, this whole border thing is now a big problem because it affects me and my city. They're always great about pontificating from afar, but when it affects them, then the issue changes. I even saw Democratic Governor Jared Polis from Colorado. This didn't get much attention, but he is also busing people from Denver into New York City, the illegals. So there you have a Democratic governor that is now following the lead of Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida. So it's interesting times.
Yeah, and the news cycles move so quickly. Biden's visit a week ago Sunday to the border is not even news anymore. It was kind of an embarrassment. It was only 4 hours. He never even went to a migrant camp. They were cleaned up in El Paso, so he didn't see any. I don't know who he scored points with, other than just getting some footage to use for his election campaign.
Well, that was probably what it was about. It was a clear photo op, and even the media kind of saw through that. So it just, maybe that's all it was, to get some footage of him going down at the border, because he certainly wasn't there to get to the bottom of the problem or even talk to people that were involved with trying to make the border more secure or what the whole situation is down there. So just a pure political move, but it's one more indication that this talk of him running again is real. That tells us very much that he is looking toward announcing reelection.
Yeah. You got all sorts of hearings that are going to be starting from the Republicans in the House. They've sent out document requests to the administration. There are four or five things right off the top that are going to be investigated, aren't they?
Oh, very much so. And I think, too, I hope the focus really turns to a lot of these investigations of making the government work better for the American people. I think if it's framed in that guise, it will be viewed better. If it's viewed as just like some political revenge investigations, then it's not going to have much credibility. But the government is unaccountable and it is not responsible. And if they can use the investigations to make it more so, then I think that will be a hit with the voting public. Otherwise, it better not look like this is just a tit for tat coming out to try to even the score of what the Democrats did to Trump.
Yeah, the kind of stories that you're seeing emerge are along the Hunter Biden paying rent to the Biden family, you know, like $49,000 a month for a one room and a house, and, you know, alleged whatever money laundering. You know, it's going to be interesting. Democrats aren't going to cover much of it, are they?
It must be a fabulous house for $49,000 a month to rent.
Right.
This is just getting worse by the day. And now $49,000 in rent? I mean, they didn't even cover it up very well.
So where's the Justice Department on this? Are they going to do anything at all or just sit back and watch it unfold?
Well, I think the latter. I mean, they've proven they're not going to do anything.
Yeah.
It's very much of a double standard. I mean, the Justice Department is sort of an adjunct of the Democratic National Committee in the way it appears.
Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. Thank you for a look back at the week in politics. We'll visit with you again next week.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Murders in the U.S. are becoming increasingly concentrated in densely populated urban centers in just a handful of counties. That's according to a newly released report. We're going to hear about that report from the Crime Prevention Research Center. John Lott is joining us right now to talk about that, and he is on the news line. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, great talking to you. Thanks for having me on.
Set this story up. I mean, anecdotally, it sure sounds like it when you just read the news and see the stories, but this is suggesting that a very focused area is where most of this takes place. And obviously, the question people are going to want to know is, are there any reasons for that? Is it policies? Is it something the government's doing or not doing? Let's talk about it.
Well, there's been increased concentration of murders in the United States over the last half dozen years or so. If you go back to 2014, 69% of murders occurred in the worst 5% of the counties in the United States. Since then, that's gone up to 73%. And if you look at those counties, what you find that is even within those counties, the murders tend to be very heavily concentrated in small areas. 30% of the zip codes in Los Angeles County account for 86% of the murders. You have 40% of the county zip codes in Los Angeles County account for only 1% of the murders. And you see that in other places too. In fact, some other places is maybe even more concentrated. In the last few years, while it's still concentrated within Los Angeles County, it's kind of spread out to some zip codes that previously didn't have murders. But it's still, you know, at 86% of the murders in 30% of the counties, that's still fairly concentrated. But, you know, your question, policies have an impact on these things. Has an impact not only on total murders, but it has an impact on where the murders are occurring. You know, in Los Angeles County, you have a district attorney who's refusing to go and prosecute many violent criminals. You've had cuts in the police budget. You've had liberal judges in Los Angeles County, as well as other places across the country, over the last couple of years that have released large percentages, you know, 50% and many places even more of the inmates who are in prison there. So if you make it so that it's not risky for criminals to go and commit crime, you're going to have more crime. And unfortunately, these areas where we're already having a lot of murders are areas where Democrats have been making it so that, you know, law enforcement is operating even less effectively than it used to.
John R. Lott, Jr., PhD, is president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. All right, let's talk more about the decarceration or the releasing of criminals. I remember living through COVID a few years back, and didn't they make that one of the reasons why they had to dump out the prisons and the jails, that, you know, it's too congregate living can be dangerous, and so let's get as many people out as we can. I raised my eyebrows when that took place. Is some of that from that? Is that some of the result?
Yeah, no, COVID had something to do with it. It obviously provided a pretext for releasing a large number of the inmates that were there. You know, as I, even in some places, over two-thirds of the inmates were released. But, you know, here's the thing. Criminals tend to be fairly young people. We know that young people, you know, in their 20s, weren't really at risk with regard to COVID. Now, maybe one thing to go and release inmates who are, let's say, over 65 or something, where, you know, there was a significant risk, or people that had, you know, real comorbidities that were there. But, you know, you don't have a huge number of people in prison that are obese. And, you know, you have other issues that are there. But instead of kind of being thoughtful in terms of who they were releasing from jails, they pretty much just had massive releases. I mean, you can't really justify on, you know, age restrictions or on comorbidities, releasing over half or two thirds of the inmates from the population that's there. Instead, they just had arbitrary rules about who they're going to release rather than, and this is even going into 2021, the huge percentages that they're releasing. And beyond that, not only did they release a large numbers of inmates, but they effectively stopped putting people in jail, even young criminals. You could have somebody 18, 19, 20 years of age, and they just wouldn't prosecute them and wouldn't put them in jail.
Yeah. And then there's other factors. I've been doing this so long. I remember AB 109 that pushed, you know, prisoners down onto the local jails. And, of course, they didn't have room, so they put their people out. The defunding of building new prisons, the closing of being allowed to use private prisons because they aren't unionized or ship them out of state, can't do that. And then a couple of propositions that were hoisted on the people with irresponsible names, Prop 47, Prop 45, things that have decriminalized the stealing of up to $900 a time. All that going on and this attitude by these DAs who believe that the criminal is the victim, and that's how we get here. How do we change that? Right. How do we fix that? That's the question.
Sure. No, I mean, I think you've summarized it exactly right. Look, the essentially decriminalization of thefts up to $950 are a perfect example. You've dramatically lowered the penalty, and guess what? You have a lot more of that type of crime that's occurring. People go and steal, and then they go and put the products that they steal up on eBay and resell them. They get a fine, but the fine doesn't really deter them because they make more money selling the products on eBay than even when they do get caught and have to pay the fine.
Yeah. But, so it's just, but how do you go from selling things on eBay that you steal for $950 to murder rate going up? It seems like there'd be a big gap between those two facts. Your thought?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously there are different types of crimes and different people that may be committing those crimes, but the same thing. I mean, just the example of the theft for $950. This is an example of when you lower the penalties, when you make it so it's not risky for criminals to go and commit crimes, they commit more of those crimes. But you've seen the same thing happen with murders. You've had cuts in the police budget. The arrest rate for murder has gone down. You know, the likelihood that they're going to be prosecuted and convicted and end up in jail for those things have been reduced. So guess what? You have more of those types of crimes that are occurring. And so, you know, it's the same basic point. If you make it so it's not risky for criminals to commit crimes, whether it's the theft of property at your local store or whether it's murders, you're going to see more of those types of crimes.
Yeah. And then you hoist onto the public the idea that it's police officers killing of innocent people, and that deters the police from being able to crack down, even when the stats don't prove it out, right?
Yeah, no, exactly right. So, look, you know, to me, this and you, this is pretty obvious, and you think it'd be obvious to other people, but, you know, maybe it is, but they still, but the thing is, you know, Democrats claim that they care about the poor, that they care about minorities. Where do you think these crimes overwhelmingly occur? Who are the victims, direct victims of the crime? But it's even much more than that. People are harmed in many other ways in these areas. You know, businesses are being forced to close because of the crimes that are being committed against them. You know, the thefts that we're talking about before. I mean, even Walmart now is talking about closing lots of stores in urban areas. You have people who would have worked at those stores who are losing their jobs. You have people who shopped at those stores now that aren't going to be able to go and shop at those places. You have people that own houses in these areas whose property values go down because of the increased crime that's occurring there. Who do they think is harmed in all those different ways? It's basically poor Blacks, poor Hispanics who live in those areas the Democrats claim that they care about, but they're putting the rights of these criminals, even not just the rights, but kind of, you know, the easier life for these criminals over and above the livelihood and real world lives of all these people that live in those areas.
Yeah. Your list of hot zip codes, of the dangerous zip codes in L.A., for example, I would suggest that they probably are not of the affluent areas, but they're of urban areas.
Yeah, of course. Sir.
High minority concentrations, and the crimes are being perpetrated on those who can least afford it.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, the thing is, you look at Black murderers, who do they murder? Over 90% of Blacks are murdered by other Blacks. Whites tend to murder whites, Hispanics murder Hispanics. But, you know, you have, you can see where the murders occur, and they are in poor, heavily minority areas. That's where it occurs. As I said, 86% of the murders in Los Angeles County occur in 30% of the zip codes. It's very heavily concentrated.
So how come the police can't just go into these neighborhoods and clean them up? Are there other issues stopping them?
Well, I mean, they do. I mean, any smart policing policies put police in the areas where the crimes are. You don't put a lot of police in areas where there are not a lot of crimes, or at least that's not what you're supposed to do. And you got to put them there, but you need more police. You don't need cuts in police budgets, but you need more than just the police. Because if you have a system where once the police arrest people, they're immediately put back out on the street, either because of bail reform or you have a district attorney who's refusing to prosecute many of these crimes, you demoralize the police and you make them have to ask, you know, is it really worthwhile me even going and arresting these guys to begin with? Mm. And you make their job a lot more difficult when you have fewer police that are having to go against what's even a big increase in crime. You can't expect them to go and solve things like murders if the murder rate's higher and you have fewer police. So you have, you know, a fewer police trying to solve each murder that's out there or each other crime.
Right. Out of time. Murders in the U.S. very concentrated, and they are becoming even more so. John R. Lott with us from the Crime Prevention Research Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Up next, the series of winter storms that slammed the Southland led to the capture of more than 33 billion gallons of stormwater. We'll talk about how this is being done and what it could mean for Southern California. Then we'll talk with a Paralympic medalist, Jamal Hill, who's on a mission. He's pledged to share his story and provide as many elementary students as he can with an important message. We'll learn how he'll be attending countless schools in Southern California throughout the year to share the importance of disability awareness. He shares his life story with us and how he's empowering students of all abilities. Stay with us. That's next.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
The series of winter storms that slammed Southern California led to the capture of more than 33 billion gallons of stormwater, which can be used as future drinking water in L.A. County. We're going to talk about this with Brett Barbary. He is joining us right now. He's president of the Yorba Linda Water District. Brett, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always great being with you, Larry.
Now, this was a program that was adopted by voters through 2018's Measure W to mitigate drought. We actually have figured out how to capture some water. We used to talk about how, wow, it's raining, but it all runs down and into the ocean. Not the case anymore in some places, right?
That's correct. The traditional, this is water 101. There are four reasons why you build dams. Flood control, water storage, power generation, recreation. They've taken out the recreation, power generation, and really the flood control piece, and they're just using it for water storage. And it's great that they're capturing that. It's about 101 acre-feet of water, and given that the city uses over 500,000 acre-feet of water a year, it's a small amount, but still it's significant that they can capture that storm flow and use it productively. We've been doing that in Orange County for years, and it's been very effective, very efficient.
So where do you put 33 billion gallons of stormwater?
Well, I think in L.A. they've built a series of collection areas, and they also have they've built into their system where, regular storm runoff doesn't necessarily go into the storm channels. They allow it to percolate into the groundwater basin, which is great. It's not terribly efficient because, as you know, you can't force percolation into groundwater basins. That's why a lot of times in California, we build large reservoirs to hold the water and then allow it to percolate slowly into the groundwater basin.
Yeah, you think of these reservoirs that have become kind of like boating lakes and stuff that are out in the Inland Empire. But I'm thinking Los Angeles itself, that's pretty good to be able to store that. Now, 33 billion gallons of water, I was reading that it's enough to get water to like 800,000 Angelenos for a year. That's not bad.
Yeah, no, that's not bad. That's a real tight calculation. That's saying eight people use an acre foot a year, and it's usually been traditionally two to four, so it's kind of almost doubling that. The other thing you have to remember is with a lot of these stormwater capture processes, it's very, very expensive water. And it's kind of silly to let it all run out to the ocean, but I'll give you an example. The LA River is concrete lined. The Santa Ana River here in Orange County is not concrete lined. You have some riprap on the side to deal with some of the flooding issues. But for the most part, you have just sand and ground to allow the water to percolate down into the groundwater basin quickly. We've worked very efficiently with the Army Corps of Engineers to deal with the dams and the releases of the water that come down. And primarily you want storm control, you want flood control, but we also have the ability of diverting the water off to the side and holding it until it percolates. So LA County is actually trying to go back and emulate a lot of what Orange County is doing by getting rid of the concrete line channels and hopefully allowing that storm flow to get into the basins.
Yeah. This rain, I guess I was looking at some of the numbers. The Weather Service was telling me L.A. County from the season is 12 inches so far, 7 inches in downtown Los Angeles just from January alone. That's not bad. What about other places in the state? Northern California got walloped even harder. Some of these lakes like Shasta are coming up a bit. I'm thinking about, though, out in Nevada and the Colorado River and the Hoover, I guess, the dam and all that. A lot of Lake Mead was really low. I mean, this it's going to still take some time. We're not done yet, are we?
No, I don't think we're done yet. In California, really, the two big reservoirs you have to look to are Shasta, Lake Shasta, which is on the federal system, and Oroville Lake, which is the beginning, if you may, of the State Water Project. Really, looking at the snowpack in Northern California, it's at 250% in many areas, which bodes very, very well. The challenge today, though, is we still don't have enough storage. So a lot of these reservoirs that are filling up, they're starting to release the water already, which sounds counterintuitive. But once again, let's go back to one of the main reasons you have these large reservoirs. It's for flood control. And so they need to make space for the melting snow that will come later on. The Colorado system has huge capacities, so they're able to do that much better. They've got four times the capacity of storage than they do average flows on the Colorado River. In Southern in California, we're about half of the capacity. Mm-hmm. So if we had more off-stream storage like Sites Reservoir and other places like that, you can hold the flows from the big storms, and then you can transfer it over to an off-stream reservoir to hold it and still have the flood control space in the reservoirs. That's why it really takes a much larger network of on-stream and off-stream reservoirs,
right,
really, to fix the state long-term.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I mean, we got all this rain and we got the snowpack. They're going to have to let some of the water out now to make room for when things start to melt, and they have no place to put that. If we had a system that said, okay, we had all this rain, it's sitting in Oroville, it's sitting in Shasta, let's move some of that to these storage places along the way, then we'd have room for more rain or more melting, but we don't, so we let it go. So there's still problems.
That's right.
It's still frustrating, isn't it?
It's very frustrating. Well, you look at the LA Aqueduct. It's a great facility. It brings water. You know, Southern California doesn't have a lot of water, but we engineered our way out of droughts and allowed for growth. But the LA Aqueduct has no storage. So whatever comes down, if they don't take it, they lose it. And if you remember back in 2017, they were getting so much water, they came to Metropolitan and said, hey, we'll give you this water just so we don't lose it. And so Met worked a deal to put a lot of the water into groundwater basins. But, you know, when you have these substantial storms, when you start having the floods and runoff, you may have to shut off the pumps at the bottom of the delta because there's nowhere else to put it. There's no more storage in Southern California. That's why I've always said to make Southern California 100% drought-proof, we need one more Diamond Valley Lake, which is an off-stream storage facility, where we can put state water or Colorado River water there.
Yeah.
And when you have the big storms, just put it in there and hold it.
Well, we spend billions of dollars on a lot of things. What keeps that from being done? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer. They always talk about a drought. Seems like you'd have a consensus in Sacramento and maybe even get some federal dollars in here. Why don't they find a place and build it out there? There's a lot of land out in the middle of nowhere.
There's a lot of land out there where you can actually build it. The problem is every time you try to build it, someone's going to come by and sue to stop it. I mean, you know, in the middle of the drought last year, there was a proposal for a private company to build a desal plant in Huntington Beach, which would have provided 50,000 acre feet of water, which is, 50,000 acre feet versus 101 acre feet, what they're capturing in LA. So producing a substantial amount of water and, they turned it down and said, no, we don't want a private company building these things. So it's just mind-boggling. In the middle of a drought, they'll stop the construction of solutions.
Well, and a couple desal plants did get approved, though, didn't they, this year?
Yeah, one down at Dana Point, which is a pretty small one, but it's a good plant. It can grow, but it's a relatively small plant. You need to be building them bigger. You know, Israel, their goal is to have almost 900,000 acre feet of desal water. And, you know, they're moving towards that because they realize they need the water to survive. It's good for their ag. And it's good for their communities, and they're growing by, I think, 2% a year.
Yeah.
They need to make sure they have water.
There is a theory that those in the political realm, in order to have us under their thumb, they need a drought. They want the power of being able to tell us when we can water and when we can't. They want there to be this climate change model story that they're always pitching, and fixing it and solving it doesn't fit that narrative. Is that possible?
Well, I think that's more than possible. I've always said a drought in the water community is like a pandemic for the healthcare community. They love that power and control. And that's kind of what we're stuck with in many ways. And we have known since the 1960s what we need to do to make this state drought-proof. And we started it. We built the State Water Project. We can take a drop of water from the Oregon-California border, move it down to the San Diego-Mexico border. So we have a tremendous system. We just have some congestion in the middle and not enough storage.
Yeah.
And when you have storms like this in any year, 14 days is more than enough to fill up all the reservoirs to get you through any bad summer.
Yeah. Well, and didn't they have a plan to build two giant pipes going from Northern California down, and they've cut it already back to one? I mean, so where's the will to do anything?
I've always said the engineers figured it out. It's a lack of the political will, and it's always easier to file a lawsuit. We stopped building on the State Water Project in 1973. It's the same year that NEPA and CEQA really came into being, which has been used very successfully to stop most of these projects.
Another quick theory.
And it's a shame because
there's another quick theory that the environmentalists don't want more housing in California. And if they can say there's not enough water, then they don't have to build, even if there's a demand for it. I'm out of time. Go ahead. Last 30 seconds.
Well, I was going to say that they keep pushing for higher and higher density living. They don't like people with homes, with grass, and swimming pools. They think that's what causes droughts. And people are going to come to California. The weather's great.
Yep. We just don't want to tell them about all the expenses out here.
That's right.
Brett Barbary, thank you so much. Yorba Linda Water District, appreciate you being on the program today.
Always great talking with you, Larry. Take care.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
My guest is Paralympic medalist Jamal Hill. As a representative of the United Nations Envoy on Youth, in partnership with Team USA and the SoCal Swim Project, an initiative of the Swim Up Hill Foundation, Jamal Hill has pledged to share his story and provide as many elementary students as he can with a message, and we're going to find out what that message is all about. He's with us right now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Larry. Wonderful introduction, man. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Swim Uphill Foundation is yours, isn't it?
You know what? I founded it, but believe it or not, it belongs to the people.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got here.
Yes, sir. Again, wonderful introduction. I'm a lifelong swimmer. Been swimming since I was a small child. Come from an interesting background, though. My mother, who put me in swim lessons, never had the opportunity to learn how to swim, mainly just because she was a young woman growing up in a time where her mother didn't think it was safe. That ultimately led me into swim lessons, competitive swimmer at a young age. And at 10 years old, my life was turned upside down. I was diagnosed with a hereditary neuropathy called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. And ultimately, that put me into a state of paralysis. So I went from being this normal kid, you know, running, jumping, having a great time, to now I'm paralyzed in the hospital. And I'm on the road to recovery. And what that road to recovery looked like for me was pretty much coming into this new body where from my knees to the soles of my feet, I had 0% nerve capacity. So literally, even to this day, it feels like I'm walking on my kneecaps. And from my elbows to my fingertips, I had 30% nerve capacity. So, you know, I'm no stranger to overcoming challenges and overcoming fear.
So you have this challenge, but you also, as you said, no stranger to overcoming these challenges and fears. What did you do? I mean, there must have been a day in which you could have been really depressed, or you said, okay, let's go forward. When was that, and how did you get to that point?
You know, actually, that I won't say that that day happened when I was 10 years old. I think just youth and the support of my family, it really brought me a great sense of peace, a great sense of calm. That, and I didn't really know what was happening. You know, I had the experience, obviously, firsthand, but I didn't have a name to put to this. My parents ultimately decided that, you know, this young man is growing up, and he's going to have enough challenges. Young black man growing up in America, enough people are going to be trying to tell him what he can and can't do. And I think ultimately their fear was that my quality of life may become limited to some book that describes this disease. So they chose a different route. That's really how it manifested for me. You know, so I had a really strong mental and spiritual upbringing that really kind of helped me push my physical limits in some ways. And in some ways, it wasn't the best, actually.
So tell us about what it is you do and how this has opened up in Olympics, the Paralympics. Tell us about what you do, because you've done very well.
Absolutely, man. Well, you know, what I do, you know, again, my profession, I tell people I do three things. One, I swim. I teach people to swim, and then I teach other people to teach people how to swim. So I swim professionally for the Paralympic Movement Team USA. I had the privilege and honor of winning our country a bronze medal 2 years ago in Tokyo at the Paralympic Games. And I teach people to swim, really one in my part time, you know, just freely. Anyone who meets me and has a connection, I invite them to our pool. I've been a lifeguard for over a decade in my life. And I teach others to teach others to swim through the Swim Uphill Foundation, which is where we are reaching 1 million people a year and teaching them how to swim.
And this is everyone. You're not just saying, okay, I'm focusing on those who may have some challenges with swimming. You want to get everybody swimming.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the world will swim. So that goes from people with disability, non-disability, the young, the old. Our focus, however, 100% is on those with not as strong economic backgrounds, because ultimately drowning and lack of some education really is a poverty and social class issue. So we start there, and ultimately that becomes reflected in certain demographics, you know. So we definitely do have a strategy about how we go about it, and we meet people where they are with what they have. I think that's what makes what we do truly special and accessible. Right.
And really, for everyone, you know, it's daunting at first when you're a kid and you look at a swimming pool and they tell you, don't drown. Okay, you can go up on that diving board. I remember I don't know if I was 5, 6, 7, whatever the age was, walking up the ladder to the diving board at a, you know, community pool. And when you're a kid, it was, you know, probably one floor up, but it looks like you're 15 floors up, and there's this little pool down there, and suddenly I got this hesitation, and there's the lifeguard with his whistle, whistling to jump, making a big scene of it, and, you know, I did, and I overcame that thing. But we all, I guess, have a little bit of a barrier sometimes when it comes to swimming, and you're helping kids to get past that.
Absolutely. And even your experience, man, number one, I think I've definitely had that experience. But I'll tell you a quick side note. I was on the swim team. I was, you know, a very adequate swimmer. And I watched the movie Deep Blue Sea with my parents. And then I came back to swim practice the next day, and I was afraid to get into the deep end because I didn't know if a shark was going to be in there, right? I knew it was impossible, but that kid's imagination. That said, you and I, you from the diving board, and me being afraid of this shark in the water, even that, both of us are expressing a high level of privilege. Again, the focus behind our work is really meeting people at level number one and getting to them to the point to where they could even just swim, right? They can swim well enough to save their own lives. And, and from there, maybe they can enjoy some form of recreation from it.
Is swimming still not really a part of, you know, they didn't even have a pool in my elementary school. I mean, did most elementary schools, I don't think, have swimming pools. I mean, if you think about it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Most elementary schools do not have swimming pools. Swimming is actually really kind of the last great endemic facing our society. I really hate to be morbid here, but I think it's important just to highlight, brother, you know, drowning is literally the number one cause of death for children under 5, and it's the number 2 death for children under 14, a top 10 reason for death for everyone under the age of 18. So it just goes to say that we have this really huge problem that is somehow being missed over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So that's just it. That's where we're stepping up, and that's where we're looking to fill the void.
So when I was a kid, I remember getting my beginner and my advanced beginner cards, and they had a Red Cross symbol on them, and they were, you know, taught through one of the local high school pools, you know, in the summertime. I took these classes.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a little kid. Where do kids go today to learn to swim?
That's a great question. A lot of kids obviously do still come to public facilities to learn how to swim. They go to their LA, they go to the county, they go to the city. There are private programs, obviously we're all familiar with organizations like the YMCA, the Boys and Girls Clubs. But the sad truth is that most of our youth are not learning how to swim. So they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, they're sitting in front of their toys, the screen, if they're doing anything. I hear the kids don't even go out and play anymore, don't climb trees. Is that true?
You know what? I'll tell you this. I'm not a kid, but I witnessed the exact same thing, and that's why, again, with the Swim with Phil Foundation, a lot of the things that that we focus on are meeting people where they are. So a lot of our methods for teaching students how to swim and getting them involved actually has a tech integration. We have affordable technology to where students can use their iPhones, right? Everyone has an iPhone these days. It's the craziest thing. Everyone has a smartphone. They can use their smartphone, and they can use these cardboard, really accessible VR headsets that our foundation produces, and they can be transported into any aquatic environment as a part of our program. So not only are we teaching students how to swim at the pool and in the school, but they're also able to take that experience home and share it with their family.
Wow. So a virtual reality swimming and getting it to the masses. That's amazing.
Yes, sir.
Wow. They didn't have that when I was a kid. They didn't even have iPhones, obviously, when we were kids. But I bet that draws them in. They love the tech gadget aspect of it.
Absolutely. Again, you know, I just can't stress it enough. I think so much of it just comes down to meeting people where they are, you know, so whatever resources they have accessible to them, that's what we want to use. We want, you know, this is something that is absolutely necessary. Our family believe and know it to be a human right. And so as that, right, somebody's got to step up and fill that void. And guess what? People appreciate it. They appreciate things that they can connect to. They appreciate things that really kind of involve what they're already interested in. And that's really just the help that we're working to bring to pretty much the educational system, right? We're an educational organization teaching swimming.
Sure.
So we want these students to be engaged. We want them to be interested. And, you know, if they go on to the diving board or to become one of those lifeguards with the Red Cross or even maybe a Paralympic swimmer like myself, oh, man. That is kudos, 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 but I guarantee you this, they will for sure know how to swim.
Yeah. I'm still a little scared of the diving board. I mean, it was fun, and you feel like there's a great sense of accomplishment when you go splashing into the water and, hey, you come up again, and you're there, and you're swimming, and, you know, it's great, and you go and do it again, and it's fun. You overcome that obstacle, that fear that you have. That's what it's kind of all about, isn't it?
You know what? That is what it's all about. And what's interesting is we also, you know, we're reaching the youth. We're very focused on elementary schools. But we also do have methods in our program to help people who are actually suffering from true fears of water. Because maybe they had a previous drowning experience in the past. That's a big barrier for a lot of people. You'd be surprised. But that's the biggest thing. Swimming isn't rocket science. I say it all the time. Only thing like rocket science is rocket science.
With that, what is the website for people to learn more about your foundation?
Oh, lovely. Absolutely. Please visit us at swimuphill.org.
Swimuphill.org. Jamal, yes, thank you so much. Good to talk with you. Much success. Continue.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.